From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You know, thanks to personal computers, more people now know what a font is than they ever did in the past. You can have a perfectly intelligent conversation about fonts with a 9-year-old nowadays.
That's Matthew Carter, and he should know. He designed Verdana, the internet font. If you've seen words on a computer screen, you've seen his work. In fact, you see the work of font designers everywhere. If it's got words, it's got fonts. And those typeface choices are rarely arbitrary. Someone is trying to communicate something to us by the fonts they choose. So this hour, we delve into the world of fonts. And where better to start than with Gotham? No, not Batman City. I mean Gotham, the font. Gotham was created by the team of Jonathan Heffler and Tobias Freer-Jones. Though Gotham has had many uses, it's most famous for one. Gotham is Obama's font, the font of hope and change. Jonathan Heffler and Tobias Freer-Jones spoke with Anne Strainchamps about the genesis of Gotham.
Well, it had a very humble beginning. When Tobias and I began working together 10 years ago, one of the things that we'd noticed, we'd pass all the time on the street on the way to meetings, is the Port Authority bus terminal in New York City by Times Square. It's a very ordinary building, and it has a very ordinary sign. And the sign on the side that some anonymous metalsmith must have made 40 years ago just looks like what we think of as kind of average lettering. Someone designed the thing to look unmannered and simple and just to say nothing more than the message. But the letters themselves are especially attractive, and we began thinking that maybe this bit of lettering could be extrapolated into a full typeface and then finally a full family of typefaces.
It was clear that this first example was made by an engineer and not a designer or a typographer or any of the more sort of usual practitioners of lettering. And that kind of plain-spoken kind of workman's attitude is what we tried to use to tie together this whole family.
But it was also a theme of lettering that we began to see more and more in the environment. I mean, once we'd identified this one artifact that would be the seed for the typeface, we began to see it everywhere. We'd see painted signs, we'd see gilded numbers on office buildings and plaques in cast bronze, and begin to see this same kind of theme emerging of these very undesigned, plain-spoken-looking letters that all influenced the development of the Gotham font in their own way.
That's fascinating. So something that most readers might not notice when they're reading something that's imprinted in Gotham typefaces, that there's a whole kind of historical subtext to this particular typeface.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very funny question to ask things like where a reader might have seen our typefaces. If we've done our jobs right, they've never noticed our typefaces. I mean, they've seen them on their toothpaste tubes and on the dashboards of their cars and their cell phones and everywhere else. But these are designed artifacts that are not really meant to be conspicuous in a lot of ways.
That must be sort of an odd thing to do, to spend your life designing something that's meant to, in some ways, be invisible.
Yeah, I think most professions are actually like that, but it is odd to give visible form to something that's ubiquitous but not really commented on.
So what are the fundamentals a font designer has to consider when creating a font? I mean, what makes a good font?
Well, I think there's a kind of tightrope to walk between getting the identity of each letter across and making it clear that, you know, the A is the A and not something else, and the B is the B and not something else, and having enough variety in these shapes to make those identities clear, but also to have a kind of unity between these shapes so that they can be rearranged in any kind of arbitrary order and still create a coherent pattern that can be recognized and read without any sort of conscious effort.
There was a wonderful observation made by Robert Bringhurst, who is a sort of typographic historian or typographic philosopher. He said that typography is the craft in which the microscopic and macroscopic constantly converge. And that really aptly describes what Tobias and I do. Part of designing a typeface is making sure the letters are attractive, but part of it is making sure that the typeface is attractive, that when you're looking at a paragraph of text, there is a uniformity and a consistency. Nothing stands out as having too much space around it or too dark or too light or upsets the rhythm of reading.
Are there particular letters or combinations of letters that are more challenging than others? Are there kind of stumbling blocks along the way toward designing a typeface?
There are many letters kind of nest together naturally. Capital H followed by a capital E. You have two flat sides that are parallel. Anything with a diagonal stroke can be harder to space. And then you have odd combinations like a capital L followed by a capital J, or a lowercase g followed by a lowercase j in words like logjam or Ljubljana in the case of the LJ. One of the things that we spend a lot of time doing is just hunting for words. And so we have this vast anthology of oddball phrases and words that torture letter combinations in various ways. So if a lowercase f is followed by a letter with an umlaut on top, we can predict what's going to happen.
Kind of like a coach putting an athlete through her paces.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a kind of torturous proving ground for fonts.
So getting back to Gotham, this one fairly famous typeface that you designed, it was initially a commission for GQ magazine, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And what were they looking for in a font?
Well, as with most briefs that we get for commission work, there are two parts of it. One is highly emotional and the other is very practical. The emotional was they wanted something modern, clean, straightforward, unbiased.
And masculine.
Masculine, of course. but on the practical side, they wanted a family of typefaces they could use for everything in the magazine. They needed the typeface to function in small sizes, and they run some very small type in GQ, also in large sizes for the headlines. So it's used both on the front of the magazine in 72 point and on the spine of the magazine in 6 point for the price line.
Well, Gotham really came to the public attention during Barack Obama's presidential campaign. How did the Obama staff wind up choosing Gotham?
You know, I've yet to get to the bottom of that. We've talked to them several times, and I actually visited them during the campaign. I think they liked the typeface, and it was as simple as that. I know some of the visual qualities of the design recommend it. A candidate whose name begins with an O certainly benefits from a very clear, circular, dramatic O. It's an odd coincidence that if you set Obama in capital letters, every letter is symmetrical, and Gotham is a typeface that plays upon these geometries in a way that kind of underscores the virtues of those letters. Mm-hmm.
But also, I think the geometric structure of it, I think it resonates with a kind of a campaign message of making a new start and, you know, a kind of clean slate approach. And I think that the sort of the simplicity of the forms, I think, matches that pretty well.
It's also a 21st century typeface, and political typography is notoriously conservative. The typeface that the McCain campaign used was from the 1950s. The typeface that the Hillary Clinton campaign used is a descendant of one from the 1750s. Gotham, being a font from 2000, I think recommended it to the Times in a way that no other campaign was really able to capitalize on.
So I picture a group of typographers getting together shortly after the campaigns all began and sitting around and critiquing the different candidates' typographies. What would you say?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism, certainly, of the Clinton and McCain identities. We did a blog post about it in which I compared what McCain did to the kind of aftershave packaging you might find at a foreign airport. It didn't really seem of the times, and it really didn't seem to evoke the candidate either. It seemed like an arbitrary choice. And that's one of the hardest things to do with a typeface, I think, is to match it to the subject matter in a way that really feels believable.
Mm. And what about Hillary Clinton's typeface?
We're seeing something, sort of a suggestion of something a bit pharmaceutical.
Yeah, I was thinking it was either breakfast cereal packaging from the 80s or maybe a kind of sleepy literary magazine, but it didn't have the kind of vibrancy or the strength of ideas or conviction that the candidate did. It didn't seem a good match for her at all.
So looking at the typefaces early in the campaign, were you tempted to predict the outcome of the election, saying, gee, we've got two really conservative traditional typefaces in this brand new, fresh 21st century. I know who's going to win.
Well, you know, I think we had once Obama was using Gotham, I think we had a sort of understandable bias in one direction there.
Yeah. It's like having a politician hold your baby and take the photograph. It's suddenly, when you see the candidate standing in front of letters that you drew in your own office, it's a very compelling connection that's hard to shake.
You kind of got a vested interest.
Well, absolutely.
You know, Gary Hustwit, the director of the documentary Helvetica, says that typefaces are a subtle form of propaganda. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think propaganda is sort of an unloaded word, but I think they are signals of some kind, you know, which you know, the viewer may be more aware of or less aware of, just, you know, the same way that showing up to a job interview, you know, in a crisp new suit will be one kind of signal, and, you know, showing up in your pajamas will be another kind of signal.
So typography is the dress of words?
Essentially, yes. And, you know, it signals your intent, you know, to the reader, even before the content has come across, you know, whether this is very serious and credible and it should be taken as such, or if it's, you know, sort of playful and lighthearted or ironic or whatever. And, you know, a good designer can match typefaces to content so that the content's message is, you know, sort of amplified and made even more clear.
I think a marvelous proof of that are the ads you see in newspapers for movies, where they'll render the logo of the movie in black and white only, and even divorced from color, imagery, the names of the stars, anything else visual, you can immediately tell if it's a screwball comedy or it's a touching romantic picture or if it's a horror flick. There's a kind of vernacular built into all of these industries that leans very heavily on typography and on the expectation that viewers are going to understand at a glance what they're getting into.
Jonathan Heffler and Tobias Freer-Jones are the creators of Gotham, Obama's font. Anne Strainchamp spoke with them. To see Gotham and more Heffler and Freer-Jones fonts, you can go to our website at ttbook.org. When Amazon recently put out its electronic book reader, the Kindle 2, they said it would not only replace the printed book, it would improve books themselves. Jacob Weisberg of Newsweek went so far as to say, printed books, one of the most important artifacts of human civilization, are going to join newspapers and magazines on the road to obsolescence. Obsolescence? Really? Novelist Nicholson Baker decided to put the Kindle to the test. His review appeared in The New Yorker in an article titled, A New Page, Can the Kindle Really Improve the Book? Baker told Anne Strainchamps the Kindle has some obvious advantages over the printed book.
I mean, the Kindle has great advantages. If you're traveling, you can carry a lot of books with it. But for me, the first impression is of looking out the window on a cloudy afternoon. It's just a disappointingly unbeautiful experience. And I was sad about that because I hate writing bad reviews. I don't believe in bad reviews. I think that if something is not good, you just don't give it space. You move on to something that is good. So I was really looking forward to writing some kind of celebrational review about this machine. And I finally found the way, which is that you can buy books sold by Amazon that are called Kindle books, but you don't have to read them on this machine. You can read them on the iPod Touch.
And that's the experience finally that you were looking for?
Well, when the gates of relief opened for me, yes, that was the moment because I realized that I could. It wasn't that I'm saying that electronic reading is anathema to everything we hold precious, and that it's that this machine is extremely awkward. I mean, it's very difficult to flip around in books. What do you want from an electronic book? Above all, you want it to do things quickly because it's got the advantage of having, you know, electricity. It can move around. This is very slow to move around. But the iPod Touch and the iPhone allows you to read electronic books in the middle of the night. It's backlit. It has a traditional screen, a liquid crystal screen, not a newfangled screen developed at MIT. It doesn't have all of that sophisticated novelty behind it. But you pull this little handheld device out from under the pillow in the middle of the night, and you turn it on, and you don't have to wake up your spouse because by turning on the side light, you can just start reading Edgar Allan Poe or whatever it is you want happily with the screen dimmed down. It's at its lowest setting. The words are just kind of creeping out in that middle of the night way that you want them to, where they're just sort of dim voices. So I found that that was something that really changed my life. I enjoyed reading books on this little machine, which is about as wide as a New Yorker column of type.
You know, I try to be open-minded about the new technology, but I have to confess that deep down, the e-books are just, it's just one of those things I want to hate. No matter how kind of practical or clever or useful they are, I guess, want to stay a Luddite and curl up with my old, somewhat worn copy of Pride and Prejudice and turn the actual pages and smell the glue and I guess I just can't imagine preferring something electronic to the feeling I get from a book. But maybe that's terribly old-fashioned of me.
Well, no, I think that there's a good point about the fact that a book is an individual object, which means that you become attached to a particular cover and it gets dinged up and you live with this thing. The problem with an electronic reader that has 500 books in it is that you really, I find that you get sick of that particular shape because it's the shape for all the books that you like or all the books you're reading are going to have this. In the case of the Kindle, it's going to say Amazon Kindle at the top of every one. So you don't get to bond with the jacket design. And for me, I really like jackets. I like book jackets a lot. I especially like paperbacks and that new way that they've done, been doing paperbacks for about 10 years that has a slight kind of a roughness, a matte finish, and it resists spills. And I just really like book covers. I think we're in a golden age of them. And that's art. And that's these are people who are thinking very carefully about how to make something so beautiful in a store that you'll be walking past a table and your eye will be caught by something. And it'll have an author and a title and just some combination of colors and a photograph. And you'll say, oh, I need to hold that. That's lost. And we don't necessarily want to lose that. Just so we don't want to lose any beautiful kind of way that human beings make objects of craft and interest. So I think that that's a very good point. But I don't want to hate these things because I think that there are moments, and I really have to say, if you in the middle of the night can't sleep and you have this iPod and you can read little dimly glowing words and not bother anyone, that you might find that even you who likes the smell of glue would find that there was a time and place for words on a screen.
Now, so much of the experience of reading anything, whether it's on a Kindle or on a printed page or on an iPod Touch or an iPhone, it's the experience of seeing those letters. And it sounds like for you, you're very sensitive to the type itself, what the letters look like, the font even.
Oh, I think we all are. There are certain typefaces that are called good reading fonts, you know. And what does that mean? It means that they have some sort of mystical balance between being fancy enough to snag the eye, give the eye clues about what is an A and what is a W quickly, and yet not so fancy, like Gothic type, that they're confusing. And those kinds of typefaces have evolved over centuries of experimentation in Venice and in Leipzig and all the great printing centers of Europe. We're all trying to figure out what is it that really works for the eye to kind of skim along and catch clues from the tops of these letters and the edges of these letters. These typefaces work and these other typefaces don't work as well. And books just, I mean, we're at the very tail end of this tremendous tradition and books do this very well. For some reason, Amazon decided, all right, we're going to use a different typeface. We're going to use this thing called Cecilia, I guess is how it's pronounced. And it's not a reading typeface. It's kind of a sort of a half, it's a little bit of a typewriter, but with a hint of proportionality. It's not fun to read it.
You describe it in your article as grim and Calvinist. How can a typeface be Calvinist?
Well, I mean, I got a little carried away, but it's just that here are all these different books of all different tones and qualities. Some are suspense novels, some are, you know, terribly technical books, and some are bits of poetry. And the problem with having one typeface that everything is pushed into is that it creates a kind of sameness. If it's a beautiful typeface like Caslon or even Times New Roman is a beautiful typeface. Any of the ones that Janssen, Bodoni, the books are normally published in or have been published in, that's great. It's just that this one is really quite an unusual one. So I think that this machine was developed by people who weren't really book people. But saying that, even so, I mean, I know that I, in writing that piece, made some Kindle enthusiasts very unhappy. And my feeling is that if somebody owns a Kindle or a Sony reader or something and really is finding that it has changed the way they read, and they're reading much more, and they're happy with it, and they carry it around with them. I know one guy who reads it in the bathtub. That's a terrific thing, and you should just ignore what I'm saying. My job was to give my own reaction to the machine that the press was saying was meaning the end of books, newspapers, and magazines as we know them.
There's one more line I had to ask you about because it was funny. You also remarked that there was a passage in one book that you were reading on the Kindle, and you had remembered it as a funny passage, but then you read it and you didn't laugh. And you were curious, and you went and got the actual printed book out and read it, and it did make you laugh. So there's something about even the typeface on the Kindle that somehow killed the humor in a passage?
That was a revelation, and this has really ticked people off. They said, oh, you know, he's saying that things aren't funny on the Kindle. But actually, I'm embarrassed. It's true. It is true that if you give something a gray-on-gray quality and you present it a certain way, and it's not crisp and snappy, it's going to lose that little extra upper harmonic that allows you to understand it as funny. And it was a discovery for me that there was this passage that I like in a Robert Benchley humor piece from long ago. I think the piece is called Do Insects Think, I think. And there's this little anecdote about a wasp that's just great. And it isn't funny. It wasn't funny on the Kindle. It was not funny. But then when I went back to the paperback, it was great. And the clincher for me was that when I went to the iPod Touch and read the same passage a few days later, it was still funny. So I know that
it was funny again on the iPod Touch.
Absolutely. It was hilarious on the iPod Touch, which means that this is, I think, a legitimate test, a reader's test of whether the Kindle can work for humor or not.
Nicholson Baker's review of Amazon's Kindle 2 appeared in The New Yorker. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. To read his New Yorker article, just go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In font circles, Matthew Carter is a god. He designed Verdana, the internet font. He also co-founded Bitstream, the first-ever digital foundry. If you've seen words on a computer screen, you've seen his fonts. But Carter had a long typeface history before he became the Verdana guy. He designed Bell Centennial, the phone book font. He was even co-designer of, arguably, the most ubiquitous font family in the world, Helvetica. Matthew Carter told Steve Paulson his font career started in the most traditional way.
Immediately I left high school in England. I went to spend a year in a printing works in the Netherlands. Enschede's was the name of them. And they still made their own type on the premises. This was very unusual, might even have been unique. This is 1955. Most printers had given up doing that in the early part of the 16th century, but Enschede's had a proud tradition of designing and making their own type by very traditional means, by hand. So I spent this rather curious year sitting in the type foundry learning to cut punches in the way that type had been made for centuries. It's a rather difficult process, and in the course of a year, I didn't really get beyond a sort of journeyman proficiency, I think. But it was very interesting work, and I think it, if nothing else, it confirmed my interest in type and decided me to sort of follow that at a later time.
Now, it would seem to be a very long way from punch cutting at a foundry in the Netherlands to designing Verdana, the font of the internet, or is it?
Well, yes and no. I think that there is an awful lot about type design that remains the same independent of what tools you use to make it, what tools you use to set it, to reproduce it. The technology of type has changed a number of times since I've been involved in it. It went from three-dimensional metal to two-dimensional film, and then from film to digital, and then to the desktop, and so on. A lot of it does stay the same. I don't know, 80 or 90%, I would think, of what goes into a typeface remains about the same. But then there are circumstances, technical circumstances in particular, where the technology does affect the design to some extent. And I think that was certainly true of Verdana, which was, you know, designed for use on computer screens, which was a very different matter from cutting punches for type on paper, letterpress printing. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about the process of designing Verdana. First, why did Microsoft see the need to design a font that would work for the internet?
Well, the reason that screen fonts exist at all as a separate category of type is that the resolution of computer monitors, computer screens, is very coarse, at least in relationship to what you get off a printer. My laser printer at home, which is not a new one, but that has a resolution of 1,200 dots to the inch. There are very few screens, at least affordable screens, that are more than 100 dots to the inch. So reproducing type or anything with any detail on a computer screen is difficult. And it was more difficult in the mid-90s when this project that became Verdana got started.
So was the key to this creating more spacing between the characters to make them easier to read?
Yes, I think that's true. Up to this point, of course, all the fonts that you saw on the screen had been adapted from pre-existing printer fonts, obviously. But what Microsoft wanted to do in this case was to reverse the priorities. In other words, it was already becoming clear, I think, in the mid-90s that more and more people were reading and writing on the screen and only printing perhaps occasionally or even never. So the old idea that what was important in type was what came out of the printer, you know, when the toner hit the wood pulp, was rather giving way to the idea that it was more important that type should be as legible as possible on the screen, with all of the problems about resolution and rounding and so on. But they had the idea, if rather than starting from a pre-existing font, maybe the best way was to start fresh and say, okay, the main priority is text sizes on the screen. Obviously, the type will have to be printable. Technology can't prevent it from being printable. It's a very good thing. But instead of having the printing aspect of it, the prime one, it should be the on-screen aspect that has the main priority. So that was the brief that was given to me. And yes, you're perfectly right. I mean, as I got to work on the job, I found that to make a different O or a different N was rather difficult. But what I did concentrate on was getting the spacing more regular so that as you're reading at these text sizes, letters don't collide with one another or you don't get big gaps between letters that look like word spaces and so on. You know, I tried to think of Verdana at the paragraph level, not as the individual letter or even the word level. I had to think about spacing between characters and the spacing between words as much as I had to think about the positive forms of the letters.
Now, of course, the other thing that we all do now is we print lots of stuff off of our computers. I'm assuming that had to be a factor as well. I mean, this Verdana had to not only work on the screen, but it had to be able to be printed as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. We all knew that. And of course, it has happened. I mean, people, as you say, have used it. I'm sitting in a booth here at WBUR, and someone's left a piece of paper on the desktop here with the station identification wording and the underwriting intros and so on. It's all in Verdana. So I think, yes, it is.
that must make you feel kind of proud, right? I mean, wherever you go, you're going to see your creation.
I don't know. I don't always recognize the typefaces I've designed. But yes, I mean, it provided they're used in a good way. It's a positive experience, I would say, by and large. Yes.
I would think more than that. It's kind of invisible or taken for granted by everyone, but it's everywhere you turn. This is the thing that you made.
Yes. But then again, I don't think you get into something like type design if you have I don't know, the kind of ego that needs to recognize your work everywhere or have other people recognize it everywhere. I mean, it is still largely an anonymous business. I mean, you know, thanks to personal computers, more people now know what a font is than they ever did in the past. You can have a perfectly intelligent conversation about fonts with a 9-year-old nowadays and so on, you know. But they still don't necessarily know there's any human agency involved in designing and making fonts. They assume they sort of materialize out of the software ether in some way. So I don't, you know, yes, it's type designers, you know, we produce raw material, really. It goes out there into the world. We are hostages to whoever uses it. And, you know, these can be typographers, graphic designers, publishers, whoever. Or, you know, someone at a radio station printing out a document here. I don't know these people. I have no contact with them necessarily. It's a sort of odd sense of remote collaboration with such people. But, you know, we are hostages. I mean, you can use a typeface well and you can use it badly.
What does it mean to use a typeface badly?
Well, there are ways that you can misuse a typeface. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example as I sit here. I mean, one thing I do notice sometimes, which I must admit annoys me, in magazines, often very well-designed magazines, they will take some quote from the text and they'll pull it out. And they'll reverse it out of a block of black or dark color, or indeed reverse it out of a photograph or an illustration. And they'll use the same type at the same size as they print the black on white text. But once you knock it out of a dark background, very often the type will sort of get eroded. It will break down. And I always feel that that's sort of unfair to the typeface. You know, you're setting it up to fail. The person who is designing the page should have had enough typographic knowledge to realize that a typeface that works extremely well, maybe black on white, would not hold up well white on black. And they should use a bolder weight or use a different typeface and so on. So these things you do see, and you wish someone hadn't done that. But, you know, it's the minority of cases, I must say, you know, having done this for a very long time, the overall effect of seeing my work in use, you know, if I pick up a book jacket or record cover or something rather than use as a face of mine, it's usually a, you know, a gratifying experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it sounds like your philosophy is basically, it's very functional. I mean, there's no such thing as the perfect font. It all depends on the use that it's put to.
By and large, for me, that's true. I think a lot of other designers could be sitting here in the seat talking to you who would take a very different view of that. I'm not the sort of designer who, I mean, if I sit in front of a blank screen or a blank sheet of paper, some wonderful inspiration doesn't descend like a bolt from the blue, you know, as it does for some fortunate designers. I'm more the sort of designer who is given some sort of problem to solve, you know. I'm given a technical situation, a brief that involves some research and so on. And then I plod through this progressively, stage by stage, and figure out an answer. So I tend to be interested. Perhaps this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, the fact that I began by being able to make type. I'm always interested in how it is made and how it's reproduced and so on. You know, people think it's strange that I'm interested in the typography of telephone directories or newspapers or news magazines and so on. But I am. I find those information-bearing designs, both in print and on screen, to be extremely interesting.
And we should point out that you're also the designer of Bell Centennial, the phone book font.
That is perfectly true. And I think that had a good deal of influence on me when I came to work on Verdana. I mean, the problems are different. The problem with the phone book, of course, is the type is tiny. It's 6-point and it's printed very high speed in kerosene and lamp black on newsprint, you know, and then thrown away at the end of the year. Verdana for the screen is a slightly different problem, but it's related. Both of them are threshold problems. In both cases, you are trying to make type perform as well as it can in a difficult typographic environment, I would say. So yes, the work that I mean, it was a long time before I did Verdana that I did Bell Centennial, but I'm very glad that I had that experience because I did learn some things doing Bell Centennial. It took a long time to do it, and I had a lot of support from AT&T and the Bell companies when it took a couple of years. And I learned a lot about the nature of digital type and so on when I was doing that. And that, I think, did stand me in good stead when I came to do Verdana.
Now, I have one last question before you go. Sure. IKEA recently changed their font from Futura, yes. which had been just a core part of their brand, their identity.
Yes.
They changed it to your font, Verdana, and this has provoked outrage among a lot
don't
of
call
people.
It, don't call it my font. You'll think I was to blame. Yes.
There was this instantaneous backlash, especially by people who were making all kinds of comments on the internet. What do you make of this controversy?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, it was fascinating, first of all, that the mainstream media picked up on it. I think the first I heard about this was an article in Time magazine, of all places, referring to what was going on online. Well, in one way, I'm a bad person to talk about this because until this all blew up, I had never seen an IKEA catalog. I must be the only person who owns a home on the planet who hadn't seen an IKEA, but I hadn't. So I don't have, 50 years of emotional involvement in Futura as their typeface. When I did pick up the 2010 edition, the one that's set in Verdana, I really sort of couldn't see what the problem was in a way. But I've lived through enough magazine and newspaper redesigns to realize that people do get very attached to typefaces and they do react when they're changed. Of course, you don't hear from the people who like it, or very seldom, and you don't hear from the majority of people who probably don't even notice, You do hear from the people with a grievance. These are the people who say, words can't express my disgust at seeing Verdana in the IKEA catalog or something like that. But as I say, type designers are hostages and you've got to take your lumps occasionally as well as the better experiences. It'll probably simmer down in time,
Matthew Carter is the designer of Verdana, the internet font. He spoke with Steve Paulson. So what about IKEA's recent switch after some 60 years from its signature typeface Futura to Verdana? The Twitterverse was up in arms.
Words cannot describe my disgust, Ben Christian.
IKEA recently changed the font they use in all of their marketing and packaging. My God. Ruff Gregor FX.
I've just signed the IKEA Please Get Rid of Verdana petition. What were they thinking when dumping Futura? Anatoly Ivanov.
It's like using Lego to build a skyscraper when steel is clearly the superior choice. See Fraser.
Why is IKEA using Verdana all over the place? Shiver. Dunkum.
Finally got the new IKEA catalog. Verdict, Verdana totally and utterly sucks. CB Guter.
IKEA's stupid. Kevin Kelso.
I'm thoroughly disgusted by the Verdana signage at IKEA last night. I had to cut my visit down to a scant 4 hours. Tony Q.
IKEA, stop this Verdana madness. Tokyo Oliver.
It's a sad day. Versace.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The Silver Buckle Press in Madison, Wisconsin, is a working museum of letterpress printing. Its letterpresses date back to the 1800s. Tracy Hahn, the director of the Silver Buckle Press, gave us a tour of her most famous letterpress, a Golding Official No. 6, nicknamed the Trolley.
Walter Hamady, who taught books here for many years, is a book artist who is from Wisconsin, although internationally known, said that bookmaking and letterpress printing was a low-level, out-of-body experience. This is 19th century cast iron technology from the 1890s. This is a platen-style press that's called a clamshell because the plate has been rotated up at this angle, and you can imagine a clamshell opening and closing. It has self-inking, meaning the rollers are attached to the press, and they ride up rails over the type that's locked up in a chase, and then they come up to an inking disc and pick up, get recharged with ink, and come down and go across the face of the type, and then you put your paper in, you close the press, it's making the impression, at the same time it's getting new ink, it's coming down and giving ink to the type, and you pull your fresh impression and then put a new piece of paper in. And you know, it doesn't have to be there. The ding, ding, ding is just sweet. It's just a little extra. It's not necessary to the operation of the press. And it's this beautiful little piece back here that's hitting. It's a pretty simple mechanism. Anyway, my colleague could hear it through the wall, so he always called it the trolley. Yeah.
Tracy Hahn giving us a tour of the trolley, a letterpress from the late 1800s, at the Silver Buckle Press in Madison. This hour, we've been talking about fonts, and it seems like everyone and their brother has their own personal font by now. You, too, can hire a typeface designer to design your own font. Kitty Burns Flory says it's ironic that people would spend money on a personal font when they already have one for free. It's called handwriting. Flory's the author of Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting. In this digital age, where keyboarding is a verb, do kids really need to learn cursive in schools?
Well, that's why I wrote this book. That question intrigued me when I heard, I had no idea that kids are learning keyboarding as early as kindergarten. And I thought, wow, what is that about? And that seemed so terrible to me. But of course, it is a digital age, and they need to keyboard more than they need to handwrite. But, you know, as I investigated it and talked to people, I just don't think that keyboard should be superseding handwriting. I really think that everybody should learn to do both and to do both of them well.
Of course, in thinking about it, it never occurred to me that kids wouldn't be taught cursive. Mm. Is it being taught in schools these days?
Less and less. A lot of schools have just eliminated it. Some haven't, but a lot of them have. And sometimes an individual teacher who feels strongly about it will still teach it to the kids a little bit when she has time. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of time now in class because, you know, they are learning things like keyboarding. I don't know. All the teachers that I talked to said that there's so little time. And the idea seems to be that it takes a lot of time to learn penmanship, but apparently it really doesn't. I think if they do 10 or 15 minutes three or four times a week, that's pretty good.
Well, it is a busy world. You know, and keyboards, I don't think anybody's going to argue. A keyboard is faster if you're just wanting to get the words down on paper.
Yeah, we all should know how to do that. We all should be good typists. I can't say keyboardists. It sounds like a piano player.
Well, it could be, I suppose.
Yeah, right, but
I guess the next question that occurs is, why do you care? Why is this important, do you think?
Well, you know, some people just care because they have a nostalgic reminiscences about the old days when Sister So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so taught them how to handwrite in the third grade. And, you know, by gum, kids today should be doing the same thing. And I suppose I have a touch of that. But I really think that there are better reasons than that. I think, well, first of all, a related reason is that we do live in a depersonalized world increasingly. And it's good to retain a few little individual things and things that really seem to connect you with people on a more profound basis than some of the connections that we make. You know, handwriting, many people say, is just so real. It really shows the personality of the person who wrote it. It shows that they care. It shows that they're willing to take a little extra time. So that we still tend to write, I hope, thank you notes and sympathy notes. I just wrote two of them yesterday, one of each, by hand on a nice piece of paper. So, you know, I think that there is a case to be made for that. But also, the educators that I talk to almost universally said that when children are learning to read, if they're also learning to handwrite rather than keyboard, that the act of forming the letters, it comes right out of their brain into their hand. They have to actually form them, and they learn better as opposed to just going to a keyboard and picking out that letter and punching it. There haven't yet been a whole lot of studies about this because it's something that people are just beginning to be interested in and concerned about. But the ones that have been done really show that there is still a value for having children be handwriting as they're learning to read.
There was an interview we did several years ago, in fact, that suggested information is stored in different places in the brain, depending on how you use it, so that writing a word down fixes it more clearly than simply hearing it or repeating it.
That's right. That's what they say. And more than simply punching out the letters of that word, you know, that are already there, you don't have to create them. And when you're creating them, it's just embedding that whole idea more firmly in your brain.
Yeah. So where did you learn your handwriting? The same place the rest of us of a certain age did in school repetitiously?
Yes, Palmer Method, third grade, Sister Victorine. I kind of enjoyed it. You know, it had that, it was kind of a nerdy thing, I guess, you know, a nerdy aspect of my own character. But I enjoyed that kind of repetitive, mindless, mechanical, but also vaguely artistic. You know, it was a little bit of both activity. And I was quite good at it.
As I suspect a lot of girls your age were, this was one of those things that seemed to really divide the girls from the boys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. But that's really because girls have better motor skills at that age. I mean, they may have been more interested in any way, to, you know, in making pretty handwriting and stuff like that. But they're just better at it because they're better at it.
Yeah. On the other hand, some of the great practitioners, the great creators of methods were men who cared men. Deeply and apparently early about it. What's his name? Spencer.
Spencer, yes. Yes, Platt Rogers Spencer. He was really the beginning of, well, no, he wasn't the beginning, but in this country, he began the whole idea of standardized handwriting, that everybody would be writing this fluent, beautiful, appealing and very rapid script, because as business was becoming, you know, a part of everybody's daily life, I mean, not everybody, but men who worked, they had to work in an office and they had to produce documents that were legible. So Spencer was teaching it in business schools and he founded a chain of business schools. And then along came Palmer, who really was business oriented. And his idea was that you could write faster than Spencer. You know, Spencer's method was full of flourishes and curlicues and various, you know, beautiful parts to letters that really Palmer decided weren't necessary. So he stripped it down. But, you know, we learned Palmer method and it still wasn't all that stripped down. You know, it still had plenty of flourishes.
Well, just so people can remember it, Spencer is the one whose script is used in the Coca-Cola logo.
Yes, that's right. It still survives in that one. And it's a beautiful logo. Apparently, it was created just by some clerk in the office at Coca-Cola back in the early days. He wrote out the name of the product, and it just happened to look beautiful because if you could write at all in those days, your handwriting was probably going to be beautiful.
The Coca-Cola logo is also an example of how standard use of the Spencer method could be appreciated, because, in fact, the Spencer letters were even more beautiful than the way they're presented in the logo.
Yeah, I think that they have simplified it a bit over the years. But Spencerian could range from the fairly simple, and it, of course it's not really simple, script in the Coca-Cola logo to the most amazing, you know, wonderful looking stuff that it would be. I tried in my book, so I know how hard it is. Very hard to reproduce today.
And then you come to the Palmer method, and it is simpler, but still you have the lines you're supposed to stick to and the mm-hmm. mathematical sense of style and size.
Yeah, the lowercase letters were supposed to be 1/16th of an inch high.
Somewhere I missed that along the line. No wonder I've had trouble all these years.
Sister Victorine was very conscious of that. I don't know how well she did it, you know, banging it into our heads, but I do know that that was the case.
I remember having the lined paper that you put under the paper that you were working on in order to make it appear that you had perfect handwriting.
Right, right. And it had two lines, one for lowercase and one for upper.
Exactly.
It's very helpful.
There's also some suggestion now, isn't there, that handwriting is more personal. And in fact, even marketers are using handwriting as a tool to make themselves seem more appealing.
Yeah. You know, the whole idea of handwriting fonts, that you can have your own font created from your own handwriting. And this is supposed to, quote unquote, personalize your correspondence. And even when I was researching the book, I read quite a bit about this. One of the manufacturers says you can personalize your diary entries. And I thought, how lame, you know, how cheesy to use this. this fake font, you know, that sort of looks like your own handwriting, except that there's no variation. You know,
but weren't you tempted? Did you?
Yeah, I was. I was fascinated by it, and I was going to go through the whole process. It's kind of a lengthy process to fill out the forms, and you have to make sure everything's going to connect. And so I never got around to it for the book. And you know, the more I thought about it, the more I just hated the idea. At first, you think, "Oh, this is really cute," you know. And if I got a letter, I still correspond by mail with two people. And I thought, boy, if I got a letter from my friend Sarah in Washington, who has absolutely beautiful but basically unreadable handwriting, and if the whole thing, you know, was done in this font, well, she could probably do her most legible bits and then, you know, just type it out on the computer. It'd be more readable. But, you know, I thought about it after a while, and I thought, I would be just so irritated reading this and having all the A's be the same and the B's be the same. And it wouldn't be Sarah at all. It would just be weird. I just got to hate the idea. So I never got around to it.
So you've just come off a book tour. Did you practice your signature before you set out?
You know, one of the worst things about having written a handwriting book is that when you have to sign the books, your signature should look pretty good. And yet you're signing so many books that your signature looks horrible and there's not much you can do about it. Plus, I have a little arthritis in my right hand, so that makes it even worse if I forget to take my Tylenol. So I can't say much about my signature. I'd rather not discuss it. Thank you.
has it revived that little bump on your finger, though, that we all used to have when we were practicing all the time?
The writer's bump. No, it hasn't, but I never lost mine. I still have a vestige of it on my finger. And that's a really funny thing, because when you mention that to anybody under maybe 40 or 45, they can't believe that you used to, everybody had it, you know, and didn't think twice about it. And they're saying, ooh, you know, we just never even noticed that we all had a writer's bump.
Kitty Burns-Flory is the author of Script and Scribble, The Rise and Fall of Handwriting. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Fonts, program number 111B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
Public Radio International.